Newspaperman meets such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
And here we go. The Media Project is back on the air for another week of commentary, analysis.
Comedy.
Yes, I was going to say humor, insight. And we're going to try to squeeze all that into about a half hour. So keep your fingers crossed. I'm Ira Fussfeld. I'm the retired publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York, joined by Judy Patrick, the former longtime editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, New York, and current vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. Hello, Judy.
I'm here to help you squeeze stuff in.
Excellent. And Alan Shartok is here. He's in studio. He's the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, among many other things. Hello, Alan.
Hey.
There you go. He's going to have to talk more than that. Do you think that's possible? And Rosemary Armeo is back where she belongs. She's an investigative journalist, longtime newspaper person, and hopefully we'll be able to get her to climb out of her shell and say what she really thinks.
Hello. I'm so shy. I don't know.
We have a few subjects that I think might touch buttons, and one of which is this whole business about Trump and the squad, and we'll let others discuss the merits of the dispute that's going on between the president and the four women of color in the House of Representatives. The media issue is there has been a reluctance, or it certainly was initially, on much of the media, calling Trump's comments about these women's racist. Initial reports, most of them said they were purported to be racist. They were allegedly racist. They were racist according to Democrats. CNN was a notable exception. But ultimately, it seems most media outlets are now flat out calling these comments racist. Is that the right thing to do?
Well, first of all, you have to ask this question. Who's racist?
Donald Trump.
Okay. But is everybody racist on some level? I know people will tell you that there is not a single human being who is not, you know, black, who is a racist. And then there are those who say even those who are of color are racist because of the perception of difference. But of course, as Rosemary just indicated quite correctly, when you take a look at what Donald Trump is doing, he's doing it in order to win an election. He knows he's appealing to that part of the American people and to their psyche and saying, this will get me through.
Well, so Judy and Rosemary, you're sitting at the copy desk of your respective newspapers, and a reporter goes out and covers a speech by Trump and comes back and writes a story that says Trump made racist comments. Are you going to leave that in there, or are you going to say to him, wait, you can't call a racist. You can say they're allegedly racist. Not everybody would agree that they're racist.
Right. And in the past, journalism has tiptoed around this a great deal because what you want to do is put it in the mouths of someone else. Democrats called it racist. But there are those arguing now that we should call things for what they are. If something is sexist, say it's sexist. Use strong language. A fellow at NPR was criticizing this approach, saying that it's not journalism's
responsibility
to characterize what this is, to present the facts and let people decide what's racist and not. But the other thing we can do at this point in history is to give some context, because I've never known a racist who admitted he's a racist, and I don't think a lot of people understand what racism is and how this actually might be racist. I mean, there's a lot of education to do in our world, and I think that's the thing that journalism needs to do.
So, Rosemary, would you not leave that qualifier?
I understand the entire ethical argument. Journalism doesn't call people liars, doesn't call people racist. They just present the information, they report it. They'll say, you know, this is a trope, go back to where you came from, that's been used by racists or something like that. But these are different times. I think it's time to call a liar, and a racist, and all the stuff about we don't really know what racism is. Yeah, we do. Telling four women of color in Congress to go back where they came from, which, by the way, is America, that's racist. As far as doing the ethical thing, the thing we always have done before, that's what Mueller did in his report. He just put it all out there and said to let the people decide, and it was spun and twisted, and we do not have the full impact of it. So he did the right thing with a terrible result, and I'm afraid journalists are headed the same way.
I happen to agree with Rosemary. It does, of course, raise the issue of how journalism has changed. We used to debate on this program. I'm sure you remember, Judy, I'm sure you remember. We would debate whether you should call the president a liar, or you could say he told a lie. And there were those people.
It goes to motive. Yeah. Oh, we don't really know what his intention was. All the nice things that we have said for years, and they worked. But do they work now, do you think?
And now the headline is always, the president told another lie today. We have moved from where we were at the beginning to this place where we're calling it like it is.
He said plenty of racist things in the past, I think, that the news media didn't get excited about calling racist. They always put it in someone else's mouth. What was different about this?
And by the way, Judy, not only racist, but misogynist.
Oh, yeah.
The famous quote in which he talked about women, what you do with them and all the rest of it. So at this stage, I think he almost likes it because that's how he thinks he's going to win an election, when people either call him racist or call him misogynist.
There's a difference between calling someone a racist and saying he made racist comments. Those comments were racist, and that is provable, and there's evidence of that. I was so struck by Republican lawmakers who were so unwilling to condemn racist comments because of the political implications. And I don't want the media in this country to be the same way, that for, I think, outmoded ethical concerns, we're not going to say what's really happening.
Well, Eric Rempel, who is the media columnist for The Washington Post, says characterizing statements and positions is a core responsibility of journalists. Using plain language to do so is imperative, and the media does it all the time, only with less inflammatory terms. And I guess that's thinking back. Unfortunately, I can't get away from my sports background. And I often think about how in sports, when you were covering a game, you were covering it objectively, but you did have to use subjective language sometimes. But there was no disagreement on what you were saying in terms of great catch or lousy game or whatever. It seems to me that that's what is now happening more and more on the news side. And as Alan points out, yes, we did talk many times about not using the word lie, and that's all gone away now.
So let me ask you guys a question, because it's really terribly important. If, in fact, Trump is trying to get reelected based on appealing to that part of the American psyche, which is either racist or misogynist or whatever else, does the press have a responsibility to give him what he wants? So we get a lot of mail here at public radio in which says, stop covering this guy. Don't talk about him anymore, which seems to me to be absurd.
Well, what was particularly alarming was the rally in which the crowd started chanting, send her back.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought maybe his tweet was an aberration and that decent, honest, hardworking Americans were not going to abide by this or not tolerate it. But it's like a worldwide wrestling federation game where people are yelling, send her back. This is atrocious in
America. Of which Trump was a former participant.
True.
I think I draw the line at the press trying to decide what they cover and what they don't based on helping Trump or not helping Trump. That's not our job. Our job is to report what is happening. And president making racist comments and lying are activities that we cover. But we don't decide, if we cover that, we'll help him with his base. I mean, that is the slippery slope. That's
all right, so
not our business.
Take it another, right, to the next level. CNN brought on as a guest in the wake of these racist or alleged racist comments. CNN interviewed white supremacist Richard Spencer in what some are calling another example of a news outlet normalizing far-right radicals by giving them a mainstream platform. Is CNN just trying to be fair and balanced, or is this the sort of person that CNN or other media outlets should simply ignore?
Yeah, that's an interesting question that made me uneasy. I understand why they did it. If you want to talk about racism, why not bring on an expert, and acknowledge?
Racist.
Yeah, a racist. And is he really normalized when you bring him up and say, here's a real live racist we're going to talk to about the president? Is that normalizing him? It's just simply giving airtime that is disturbing many people.
Well, here's the thing, Rosemary. In the old days, maybe you wouldn't have done it. But we now have a racist president of the United States. And we have somebody who I think has great appeal for the people who are following this president and who the president is representative of. And of course you're going to bring him on. By the way, You know, all three of you, as opposed to me, have made these editorial decisions over the years, who you get. You all have intuitive ability to put your finger up into the air and say, this is something that people are going to be interested in. You don't start talking about, is it irresponsible to bring them onto the air?
I've never had a discussion in years in newspapers and other media where we said, who are we going to get? Never.
I don't get it.
It doesn't work that way.
Well, what do you mean?
He said that you sit and you know intuitively who we're going to go get. You sit and decide it. That's not the way it works.
No. What I'm saying is if the guy is out there and you put your finger up in the air and say, okay, which way is the wind blowing? You're going to get him. It's not that you're sitting around in an editorial board meeting deciding. It's that when you have an opportunity and it's a competitive game, this is a competitive game, to get somebody who is going to say, wow, you know, look at this guy.
But it's undeniable that when you put someone in a story or you put them on the air, that you increase their stature. And,
no question.
It's subtle, but it's there, and it's you do have to be careful about who you quote. You don't quote someone who is too young. You don't quote someone who doesn't know anything about it. But do you raise the stature of someone who has actually been on the fringe for a long, long time?
Well, I just want to make sure I understand. Do you think?
Well, I don't mean the middle finger. No, I mean just the finger.
No, but are you suggesting that CNN decided to put this white supremacist on the air because they thought it would attract viewers?
Help ratings. Yeah, that's
what okay, the answer is yes.
You do think so?
I do. I believe that the idea is, look, CNN is in a death struggle with other people, with Fox, right, and with MSNBC, and the get, as we say in the business, the get becomes very important as to when people are just switching channels back and forth and saying, golly gee whiz, Martha, look at this creep. Look what he's saying.
See, I didn't see that interview, but if I turned CNN and saw that he was on, I'd change the channel. I wonder, if, based on what you're suggesting, that it would generate ratings, I think it could lose people just as easily. But the thing about putting your finger in the air, you preface that by saying the three of us have been in the business a long time and we intuitively know what to do. I think that that is what's called editing and managing the newsroom.
Yes, that's true. When,
but it's not the same as putting your finger in the air. I mean, we knew and know from experience what we should be covering in our markets. We know how much room to devote to those stories, and we make editorial decisions based on that. Now, that in a long way around is saying, yeah, we know if we do this, we will sell newspapers or attract listeners. But I think the image that you suggest of putting your finger in the air is not fair to what the editorial process.
No, I think CNN does that. They try to figure out what will sell, and that's why the number one example.
Told you, Rosemary, you got to get her off this show.
the number one example of CNN doing that and giving what Judy rightly calls was, you know, overexposing them and increasing their stature was Donald Trump. They put on those gavel-to-gavel coverage of his rallies, and that did not have the effect of people like me looked at and said, oh, my God, he's an idiot. Never vote for him. It raised his stature.
Do you solve racism by talking to a racist and figuring out how their mind works? I don't know. I mean, it's something I've always been fascinated by, but is that what is needed in mainstream or broadcast television?
Well, I'm not sure.
Wait, can I just say that I'm not sure our job is to solve racism. It's to report. That's it.
Certainly, but as a society, when we talk about talking to racists, is there a value in illustrating where they're coming from and why they're thinking the way they're thinking?
I don't want to make you guys upchuck, but I have said this a number of times. Politics is the authoritative allocation of resources, and I didn't start that. It's not my original quote, but it's true, because the press is in the business of allocating resources.
More so than ever.
Yeah. So if you've just indicated by putting on Trump rallies gavel to gavel, that's a resource. That gives this guy something that he didn't have otherwise, and the press has to make it up. Now, I want to say one other thing. Ira, you were at the Kingston Freeman in the middle of the Hudson Valley. You knew you had to be, you know, weighing things carefully. How much do we do? The New York Times is very different from the Daily News or the New York Post. Or Judy, the Schenectady Gazette, the Independent Gazette, which you were editing all that time. You had a worldview in each of these places a Weltanschauung, in which you would have to decide, is this for us? Is this representative of our newspaper and what we do? So some newspapers will do it, some won't. The New York Post will do it. The New York Times might not.
Well, are you suggesting there's something wrong with that?
No.
Okay, because I used to have an editor, and when somebody would complain, you're only trying to do that to sell newspapers. And she would say, we should never excuse the fact that we're trying to do something to sell newspapers, because if we're not selling newspapers, we're not going to be in business anymore.
There you go.
But the question is, what determination do you make as to what will sell newspapers? I always use as an example, the newspaper company I worked for owned a tabloid newspaper in Trenton, New Jersey, that was a lot like the New York Post. It had the bikini girls in the front of the section, and it sold very well at one time. Our company, nor I, would ever think of doing that kind of journalism in my market, because we know that it would not sell in the market. So you have to make those kinds of basic decisions, knowing what newspaper you want to publish and who it is that you're trying to sell it to.
Right. You have to think about what people need to know and then what people would actually be interested in reading. I can remember having these discussions in my head about, would my readers be interested in the Adirondacks? Would they be interested in the Tappan Zee Bridge? They'll probably be less interested in the Tappan Zee Bridge than the Adirondacks. I've had to make a choice. Those are the kind of choices you make.
This is
and
me.
We're all dinosaurs, because Trump doesn't look at newspapers at all. He tweets out something, and then he gets an instantaneous response. He knows whether he's hit or not.
Well, I'll get to that back in a second. Just to remind everybody, you're listening to The Media Project. I'm Ira Fussfeld with Judy Patrick, Rosemeyer Ameo, and Alan Shartok. And according to the poll by Hill-Harris, I presume that's a Harris poll, and I'm not sure who Hill is. It might be the Hill newspaper. One-third of Americans say the news media is the enemy of the people. The poll found that the sentiment is strongest among Republican voters, 51% of whom said they thought the press is the enemy of the people.
Well, that's the clarion call that comes from Trump. And these are people who follow Trump, no matter what he says. He says that the press is the enemy of the people. That, of course, puts him on a very, very difficult totalitarian track, which totalitarians and dictators for all time have always done. First thing you do is you close down the press. You know more about this than anybody I know, Rosemary.
I looked at that poll. It's 1,000 people, first of all, and so that makes me a little bit leery. And the second thing is, a third of the country is crazy. How many how much of the country believes in Roswell, the aliens at Roswell? I mean, that if it were 45%, 60%, yeah, I'd be talking about it, but I don't think it's significant.
I think it's extraordinarily significant. And I think, Rosemary, the great work that you do abroad, in which governments try to close down the press and repress things, is indicative of who this guy is and what he's trying to do in this country. If he yells out the press is bad and everybody says, yeah, how far do we have to salaam? That's very dangerous.
But it isn't everybody. It's one third of the country, as I say. You can get one third of the country to vote something crazy on anything. And the rest of the country, subscriptions are up. Support of journalists, at least anecdotally, there's information that people are beginning to get it. I'm not so sure it's a terrible poll.
I hate to do this to you, Rosemary, but let's go back to Hitler. It's exactly what the totalitarians always try to do. And by the way, when he started, he was in the minority, not the majority.
I think when he says enemy of the people, he means enemy of the Trump or enemy of the state, right, being him. He's not thinking of the collective people at all or of America.
And I guess it's worth me underscoring that while a third of the people polled think we're the enemy of the people, 67% say the news media is an important part of democracy. It said among those surveys, respondents were most closely divided on the issue in rural areas. 46% of rural Americans said they believe the news media to be the enemy of the people, compared with 54% who said no. What can we glean from that?
Well, look, take a look at who supports Trump. What percentage, Rosemary, goes back to your issue. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about a third or a little bit more of a third of the people are always in the Trump camp, does it surprise us that a third of them are going to listen to his Trump?
Leaving him. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you talk to Trump supporters, one of the things, one of the criticisms is the fact that the press isn't reporting the good news, and any of the progress that has been made by the administration. And that lessens the press's credibility in the Trump supporters' eyes.
Although, as a reporter said this morning as we speak, when the rally that he had in North Carolina took place, in which people in the audience were yelling, "Send her back," Trump was also heralding the fact that a move in Congress to at least initially begin impeachment proceedings was defeated. The point of the reporter was that once again he was stepping on his good news by doing what he did at the rally. And so, to Judy's point, I suspect that pretty much everything that he would say are his accomplishments and are not being reported have been reported, but his other stuff is overpowering it. It's day to day. We all take a deep breath in the morning when we wake up saying, what's going to be today?
I always ask supporters, what is the good news we're not reporting? And it's, okay, Supreme Court and judiciary will report the hell out of that. The economy, which mystifyingly is still doing well, although it's scary. What are we
you're
missing?
You're exactly
end
right.
End of regulations, which we report, including how clean air and water will go with it.
And those are the same people who will write us a note every day saying, why is no one reporting thus and so?
Yeah.
Where
and
did they hear it?
And it's always, exactly, where'd you get it from then?
Well, I think it was Judy, or I'm not sure, or Rosemary, who just alluded to the fact that subscriptions are up, and I don't know that I would agree with that across the board, but certainly in some places.
Well, his targeted favorites, fake news sites,
yeah.
New York Times, Washington
oh,
Post, CNN, they certainly have not been suffering by the attention he's given them.
Well, one thing that's going to happen very shortly is that print newspapers are going to be harder to sell because they're not going to be available in Starbucks anymore. Starbucks will quit selling the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Gannett papers like US Today Today in 8,600 stores beginning in September.
Why? How come that happened?
They're citing, quote, changing customer behavior.
Well, they'll still allow newspapers to be sold at Starbucks that are privately owned, but the Starbucks-owned Starbucks will stop selling the newspapers. And they were selling local papers as well at some of these Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. Well, far be it from me to be happy about this, because I'm not. But the question is, wouldn't Starbucks still be selling newspapers if they were selling newspapers? I mean, you get to the uninitiated, when you are a newspaper and you want to sell your newspaper in a store, the newspaper gets a cut of every newspaper it sells. The trade-off in part is it takes up shelf space, and so, you know, there are those kinds of considerations. But Starbucks, I guarantee you, would continue to be selling newspapers if they felt they were making money.
Starbucks has free Wi-Fi. There's no reason to read a newspaper in a Starbucks.
Exactly.
You sit there with your phone and you read the news. I do this every day.
You're exactly
right. I am a news person.
So why are we surprised about
this? We're
not. Well, I am surprised because people are paying $5 for a mocha, cafe, latte, cappuccino thing, and they're not willing to pay $1 for a newspaper.
Well, what surprises
or,
you?
Or $1 for a subscription, digital subscription to a
you
newspaper.
You don't have to. You just sign
you
on
don't
your phone.
You don't because we're stupid enough to give it away for free.
Well, yes.
Yeah, I mean, one of the commentators said again this week what many of us have been saying for a long time is that if you owned a widget store, would you give your widgets away for free? And newspapers have been giving away their content for free. It was a major mistake that the industry made at the advent of the internet. We were all so eager to get on the internet that we just gave it away. And once you start giving it away, it's hard to start charging.
Well, but the idea then, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
We keep talking at the same time. The idea then was that if you advertise basically on the internet, you will drive people to your paper.
Correct. I said that until
a million times
I
did. I know. And it didn't turn out true. But I have you noticed the trend? It's harder to get stuff online now. Increasingly, you're running up against a firewall. You have to at least register, and then you get a certain number of articles, and then you have to get a subscription or pay per article, which is increasingly a popular
idea.
Well,
it's so interesting because if you go online, and I do every night several times, and you could look at the Times if you have a subscription, which I do, but you can also get the New York Post, POST, for free.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot get the Daily News for free. They have paywalls. It obviously helps the Post. So Murdoch must be figuring with the Post that making it available for free you are, in fact, increasing your influence and your circulation, right?
Except, I believe we discussed it on this program a month or so ago, that the New York Post has announced that it is going to start putting up a paywall. We don't know when, mm-hmm. and we don't know exactly how. But they seem to have come around with that. By the way, this is my weekly tout of the Showtime series, The Loudest Voice, about Roger Ailes. If you're not watching it, you really get an insight as to what happened at the beginning of and the increasing popularity of Fox News. And parenthetically, references are made to News Corp, which owns the Fox News and the New York Post.
Well, Ira, while you're on it, maybe you could give us the headlines here.
The headline is that if you can believe the reporting on which the series is based, and if you factor in that the dramatic license that is takes place in this or any other film based on real life, Roger Ailes was asked to develop a all-news channel to compete with CNN and MSNBC. He was asked by Murdoch, whose initial motivation was put a straight news cast out. Roger Ailes said, 50% of this country is conservative. We're going to build a news channel that appeals to those people in the nation, and that is going to be
our slant. And how do you get the eyeballs? I mean, I remember one quote from Ailes about, skirts and, you know, higher and all that kind of thing. So how do you get those eyeballs?
There certainly was that, which is what led to his demise and the demise of O'Reilly and others, the sexism and harassment. And that is portrayed in the series as well.
No.
But you were talking about the legs of the
glass tabletops. So you can see underneath the glass tabletops and shorter skirts and that kind of thing. That's not harassment. That's just direct, blatant appeal.
And that is portrayed in the movie as well. Either the first or second episode, when they're doing test runs of the channel, Ailes is watching it on a monitor and explodes when he sees that the female anchor is wearing pants and says, "We want to see legs." So that is covered as well on this. It's called The Loudest Voice. It's on Showtime. I don't get a piece of the income for it, but I do recommend it. Well, we're pretty much out of town. We have time. We've got a minute left. Have we forgotten anything? Who else can we jump on this week?
One of the things we were talking about is pay-per article technology and how that's starting to advance. I would want to say that I don't want the little guys to get left out when this starts to become a trend, because what we often see is the big guys will swoop in and take away a little story, and we got to keep the local newspapers.
How would that work now, Judy?
Well, because if you see an article you want, you pay 25 cents. You use some sort of technology. It's almost like
micropayments.
Right. Micropayments. And
I'm all for that.
But then there will be a race to see who can steal what story from whom and who will get to the top of the Google search engine. What you will see is the diminishment of local news.
That's it for this week. This has been The Media Project with Ira Fussfeld, Alan Shartok, Rosemary Mayo, and Judy Patrick. Thank you very much for listening, and tune in again next week.